And taking a look at the backcountry on the fun with us, Greg from Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Yeah, you just heard the weather forecast. Warm today, warming, windy ahead of tomorrow's cold front. Maybe down in the valleys and so forth, we're not feeling the winds as much, but at the mid and particularly upper elevations in the mountains, it's quite windy with some gusts in the 50s and even 60s overnight. Really minimal avalanche activity reported from Thursday. It was really just some minor wet loose activity and a few small wind drifts. So today we're continuing with normal caution, and it sounds a bit like a broken record. We'll often say low danger doesn't mean no danger. And I do think some small avalanches in isolated areas are possible today. Two things I'd watch for. One will be wet snow avalanches. So we've had some warm temperatures this week, and snowpack has adjusted to these warm temperatures. But it's been fairly warm overnight, just barely around freezing. And I think we're going to have a decent refreeze this morning. But today's warmth, sunshine, will definitely warm up that snow surface. So some wet, loose avalanches are possible. And this includes northerly aspects, especially at the low and mid elevations. Then also the southerly winds, particularly we're finding at the mid and upper elevations, they're going to be moderate to even strong today. And there may be some pockets of fresh wind drifts along upper elevation ridges, as well as northerly aspects at the mid and upper elevations. But just like the wet, loose avalanches, I think these will be pretty small, pretty minor. And going forward, increasing winds overnight and looking like a decent storm tomorrow. You just heard the weather forecast with unsettled weather for this coming week. So for now, enjoy the generally low avalanche danger. And things will likely change, you know, elevated probably to at least moderate, I think, by Saturday.
Okay. Hey, thanks.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Tom Moyer with the Wasatch Back Citizens Climate Lobby. He'll have an update on the group's activities, including an upcoming town hall meeting. Then Park City Councilmember Nan Worrell with a recap of last night's city council meeting. And finally, I'll be talking with Neuroperformance Integration Research Director Beverly Albert. She's got details about a study she's conducting and looking for volunteers on chronic knee pain. So if you're one of those, stay tuned. 8:11 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, joining me now on the phone with an update from the Wasatch Back Citizens Climate Lobby, I have member Tom Moyer. Good morning, Tom.
Morning, Leslie.
So why don't you first just start by telling us what Citizens Climate Lobby is, who you are, and what you do?
Sure. We're a nonpartisan grassroots group lobbying our elected leaders on the topic of climate change, and specifically, we are working to bring both parties together on solutions. We're not looking to elect anybody. We're not weighing in on races. We're actually sitting down with our members of Congress and trying to bring them towards legislation that'll effectively solve the problem.
Yeah. So it's a national organization with many, many local chapters then?
Yeah, we're actually international. We have 7 chapters in Utah, one of which is the Wasatch Back chapter. And we coordinate activities and we coordinate lobbying throughout the organization.
So do you think you're making a difference?
Absolutely. it's nice to be able to answer that question confidently. When I started doing this about 6 years ago, this was a completely partisan issue. There were no Republicans who would touch the topic at all. And our first success was with Mia Love, who we actually had on a phone call earlier this week, talking to our group. She was one of the first Republicans to join the Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus. The rules of that caucus are that you have to join in pairs, one Republican and one Democrat. And since then, it's, you know, we're still a ways from passing the kind of legislation we'd like to pass, but the tone of the conversation in the country has shifted dramatically.
All right. And then how often does the Wasatch Back chapter meet?
So we have a monthly meeting and the next we just had one. Mm-hmm. So our next one will be in about a month. It's the third Thursday of the month. And you can sign up to be on our mailing list by going to citizensclimatelobby.org and putting in your information if you're in the Wasatch Back area, and you'll automatically get notifications from us. Right. We also in the summer. We were doing monthly hikes. So that was a fun way, especially during COVID, to get people together and actually talk to people. We did a hike with Congressman Curtis, one with Congressman Moore, one with the Wasatch Back mayors, and one with other environmental organizations. We're looking forward to restarting those in April.
Okay, and then again, those will be posted then on the website or as part of the updates, email updates?
If you sign up on citizensclimatelobby.org, then you'll get our notifications for those. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
Okay.
All under CCL Wasatch Back.
All right. So you've got a town hall meeting coming up at the end of the month. When and where is this happening?
So that is March 29th at 6 p.m., and it's virtual. And you can get the registration link at all of those same places. And that will be with our two state representatives that both cover pieces of Park City. Kara Birkeland covers the north part, and Mike Kohler covers the south part, down through Heber and Midway. With the mayors of Heber and Midway, Kellyn Potter and Celeste Johnson, and then BYU professor Ben Abbott, who's a climate science expert.
Okay, and what's the topic? Or is it just
the topic is it's local solutions for clean air and climate. We spend a lot of our time lobbying our federal legislators, lobbying Mitt Romney, lobbying Blake Moore and John Curtis. This one is going to focus on local solutions. So what can cities do? What can the Utah legislature do? What can individuals do?
So are you somebody moderating the discussion then, or is it just a kind of an open forum for people to ask questions, or?
No, we'll be fielding questions, and we've got three student moderators, one recent graduate. So Danny Ball is a current Princeton student. She was a Park City High graduate. Montana Burak is with the Park City High School Earth Club, current high school student. And then Cecilia Foster is a current BYU student and my co-state coordinator for Utah CCL.
All right. And I know that you've got the Wasatch Back mayors there, Celeste Johnson, Kellyn Potter, of course, Andy Bierman, working, you know, on, I guess, with these same goals as the citizens lobby. What about Representative Mike Kohler and Kara Birkeland? Are they on board as well?
So everybody's on board to different degrees, and every journey is a process. So no, Mike Kohler just took office. Kara Birkeland's in her second term. Actually, I think it was only a partial first term because she was appointed. So it's really near the beginning of the conversation with both of them, but the conversation has been started. And this will be a continuation of that and an opportunity for them to hear from their constituents about the issues that concern them.
All right. Lobby will also be holding meetings with our congressional representatives this month as well as in June. And they've all agreed to meet with you?
No. So we're only meeting with a few of them this March. We have meetings scheduled with Chris Stewart's office, Mike Lee's office, and Burgess Owens's office. We met more recently with Blake Moore and John Curtis. And so we're not meeting with them again this time around. But we will meet again with John Curtis. We already have a date scheduled in the summer, and we're working on finding a date for a town hall with Blake Moore. So we'll announce that if and when we get a date.
All right. And again, they're all on board, but just at different degrees here?
Well, I mean, what does on board mean? We have goals. We'd like them all to be further than they are. We'd like them to be actively supporting climate legislation. I think the one that you can say right now who's really effectively working on climate legislation is John Curtis. He sponsored a number of bills, and several of those became law in the last Congress, which is tough to do when you're the minority party.
Sure. Yeah. So in terms of when you meet with them, I mean, what are those discussions like?
So our focus at the federal level has been carbon fee and dividend legislation where John Curtis tells us we're trying to hit a home run. let's work on some singles and doubles first. So he knows that's our larger goal, but something that would really, really take a bite, a significant chunk out of the country's emissions, and protect lower income families at the same time. Those are sort of the twin goals. But we're happy to work on smaller pieces of legislation as well. And those are the kinds of things he has co-sponsored. Things like the Growing Climate Solutions Act that would help fund farmers and ranchers who put carbon into the soil, and things like the BEST Act, which incentivizes utility scale battery storage.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you have other singles and doubles out there that you're working on?
Yeah. Another one we have worked on that didn't pass in the last Congress, and it's going to come back around, that I would really like to see move, is called the Reclaim Act. And that is just funding for economic diversification in coal country. And that's one, this is sort of like the Dream Act. It's like there's significant majorities in both parties who agree on it, but it keeps getting, you know, kicked around and not actually attached to any legislation that passes. This is one we really ought to be able to pass. And there's benefits for Utah as well. We have distressed coal communities that could use the help.
Sure. And just given that Congress is so divided, so partisan, are we making, I guess, can you get beyond that, it just seems that, especially from the Republican contingency, they see it as the new Green Deal, or it, and they just back way off as opposed to trying to come together. Do you find some of this coming together, though, happening, or is the partisanship more important to them?
The partisanship is absolutely significant, and this topic has gotten caught up in that partisanship, where it's become a tribal marker, where when you start talking about climate change, the suspicion is that you are just coming at it from the Democratic Party and you're working against the Republican Party. And it takes some work to overcome that suspicion. And I think with these members of Congress, we really focus on building relationships. This is not just a one-time, sit down for an hour and hand them the piece of paper and they sign it. This is building a relationship over the long term. And we have built that kind of trust with our representatives, so that they actually see that we want to work with them on solutions. And I think all you have to do is look at John Curtis's co-sponsorship list, and you'll see that those kind of results of actually finding areas where both parties can agree.
Yeah. Now, do you feel like you have the people behind you, or do you have some surveys or something that you can show them? I mean, given that they are our representatives.
Yes. It's really interesting. If you look at opinion trends on this issue, there was actually a fair amount of bipartisan support in 2008 when Barack Obama got elected. And then it took a nosedive and it became very partisan after 2008, and it became associated with Democrats, part of which is because we went into a big national recession at the time. And we're now coming out of that, and levels of support are now higher than they were in 2008. And they're particularly high among younger Republicans. And that's where we really, I think, have the political success going for us, is that the younger cohort of Republicans wants the Republican Party on board with solutions and proposing ideas, and not just opposing everything the Democrats do.
Yeah. So kind of continuing with this baseball metaphor, then, the as you mentioned, the Carbon Fee and Dividend Act is the home run. I mean, have we even made it to first base on that nationally?
I would say yes. We've had it introduced with bipartisan support, bipartisan co-sponsorship. The latest, at the end of the last Congress, we were up to something like 92 co-sponsors. And now here's where the bipartisanship is a little hazy. It was like 91 Democrats and one Republican. So we would love to bring that back in this Congress with, a more balanced number of Democrats and Republicans. That's really what we're working towards.
All right. So kind of stepping back to the statewide efforts, some state legislation affecting clean air and climate, anything happening on a more local level?
Yeah, we've worked on legislation, and we've worked on that same sort of relationship building with our state legislators, and that's part of what this town hall is about. I would say this year was not a great year for climate legislation. There were a number of good bills proposed that never went anywhere. They either weren't given a hearing at all, or they died quickly in committee. There were two much smaller bills that passed that were kind of good news, but the big things were left on the table. So Dan McKay's telework bill, that was SB 15, to encourage state agencies to telework on red air quality days. That passed unanimously. That's an easy sell. And then there was an update to the state energy policy amendments by Representative Albrecht. And that actually was quite good. There was interesting committee hearing debate about that, about sort of which direction energy policy should go. And it ended up with very reasonable language, kind of in response to the Texas blackouts, about adequacy of dispatchable electricity generation reserves and storage, including hydrogen and pumped hydro and things like that. I think the motivation for that is that we're probably heading towards hydrogen storage in the Delta Utah area, and this was an update to the state policy language to accommodate that.
All right. Anything else that you wanted to mention to us?
Yeah, another thing we worked on was defeating, and I'd rather be for things than against things, but we did help defeat the increase in registration fees for electric vehicles. So that's a victory for both clean air and climate.
Sure. And again, there's that whole part, that whole issue, though, I mean, of the fairness, that they're paying a lot less than the rest of us and yet still using the roads just as much. So how do we pay for the repair and maintenance of those roads?
Right. So the state legislature is already, it has its eyes on a system where everybody just pays a per mile fee for the use of the roads. And the way we currently fund roads, the gas tax only pays about half of it. The other half is paid for by sales taxes out of the general fund. So electric vehicle owners are certainly paying their share and more for that half of the funding.
Sure. Okay.
Both for the purchases they make and the purchase of the vehicle itself.
All right, Tom. Hey, appreciate the update. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Great to talk to you.
We're on the phone with me now with an update from yesterday's Park City Council meeting. I've got Council Member Nan Worrell. Good morning, Nan.
Hi, happy Friday. What a gorgeous start to the weekend.
Yeah, thanks. You too. Let's see, some news from last night. In-person hybrid council meetings sound like they're coming back sometime in May. Are you in favor of keeping the virtual participation option open?
Oh, absolutely. The one thing the pandemic has taught us is that we needed to diversify the ways that people could connect with us and communicate with us. And you know, it's long and hard to sit through long council meetings, especially if your agenda item that you're interested in comes later on in the agenda. And so by allowing virtual participation, you know, people can feed their kids dinner and they don't have to hire a babysitter and they can listen in and then, you know, just really hone in when the item of interest comes to them. And it gives us a great way to hear from people, as I said, that don't normally connect with us.
Yeah. You have any idea when council chambers will be open to the public?
You know, we talked about last night the council getting together in person for the first time in well over a year in May and trying it with a hybrid with only council in chamber or staff in chamber the first meeting or so, and then gradually opening it up just as we check things out and we watch the health orders and all of that. So that's kind of the plan now. It's a little fluid, but we're just excited to be back together again.
Okay. Council kicked off the work session on updates from the Three Kings Water Treatment Plant and the new Community Renewable Energy Program. You brought up how due to COVID-19 that there were some 4,500 lost work hours on the water treatment project. So how confident are we that the project's still on schedule?
Well, when I read the staff report, that just jumped out at me because that's like 2 years of labor. Apparently, according to Roger, when he made when I asked the question last night, it's not going to affect it. The staff has done an excellent job of kind of adapting. Instead of doing one building at a time like they had originally planned in order to spread out the crews, they've started other buildings as well and have started to go vertical. So they're spreading people out as much as possible. But he really feels like that things are still on track.
All right. And so we're expecting the buildings to be completed by fall of 2022 and then a finished site the next spring. So mm-hmm. can we expect the golf course to return to normal before then?
Yeah, supposedly they're going to be able to have the golf course, you know, they've been doing some mitigation things. They're dredging the ponds right now, which is really a kind of a stinky mess if anybody's been by there. One of the ponds has never been dredged. And so you can imagine the ducks are actually walking across it. And so that's supposed to be completed by May.
Okay.
So and we'll be ready for this season.
And I'm just curious. I mean, the dredging of the ponds was just because they were so stinky? Is that why it was being done? Or how come, why did they need to be dredged, I guess?
You know, for water flow, for use of the water, for, you know, for like irrigation or snowmaking or whatever the ponds are being used for.
Okay.
They just got to the point that they needed to be cleaned out.
Yeah. And yeah, golf ball bonanza there, because I know I've got many, many, many.
I think we all do.
In terms of renewables, Council got a thorough update on the progress of the state's renewable energy program and the new governance process. It sounds pretty complicated for someone who's not following it too closely. So how is this going to work, this governance model?
Well, it is really complicated. You know, I've never been part of anything that's applied to the Utah Public Service Commission, and it's a big, big deal. And so 20 communities at this point in time want to participate in that. And so the staff has worked endless hours with people from representatives from other municipalities and counties, as well as, I think at one point, Luke said there's over 20 lawyers involved in getting all of this done. So it's a huge deal to get ready for the filing. And it's a way for the communities to come together and speak with one voice as we're talking about things to do with the renewable program that all of us want to be involved in. You know, but there's so much that has to be worked out in terms of governance. You know, who has a vote? Who, how is it going to be paid for? Right now, it's going to cost about $700,000 to file with to do the filings with the Public Service Commission. So, you know, how that's all going to be allocated. So, you know, in a nutshell, the way I understand it, and again, it was our first dive into it last night. He's going to come back in late April with some more information. And so they look at the total population as well as the electric load for each community to talk about the cost allocation. So for example, right now, Park City's cost allocation would be 1.926% of the overall cost.
All right. So is the council unanimous though on this and moving forward with the agreement?
Absolutely. Yeah, we didn't take action last night, but you know, as I mentioned last night, you know, I think this is a way for us to put our money where our mouth is. You know, we have made these aggressive climate goals and energy goals where we're going to be 100% by 2030. And this is one more step in that direction.
So is that, I guess, is that possible to be done, you know, have that 100% renewable goal by 2030?
Well, I don't want to jinx it, but that came up last night, and we may actually be able to achieve that earlier than 2030.
All right. The city is budgeting to become an anchor community for the program. That's expected to cost about $36,000. I guess that's spread over a couple of years, though. What are the benefits, then, of becoming this anchor community as opposed to just participating?
Well, as I understand it, by being an anchor community, it's going to increase our voting power. It's going to give us a weighted vote so that as things move forward and whenever a vote needs to be taken, it increases our ability to have a voice at that table. It also helps to ensure that the program moves forward, you know, the way I look at it. It helps to make sure that $700,000 can be committed by having anchor communities come in. And then as other non-anchor communities that want to participate but not at that level come in, then that decreases our cost. So it's a way to allocate the costs and move forward with it.
All right, let's turn to the Arts and Culture District. Councilmember Becca Gerber brought up during staff communications that the city could be doing more to inform the public and the business community about the project. That after the HPCA board this week voted against expanding the ARST, the Expanded Resort City Sales Tax, to help pay for the project earlier this week. Was it disappointing to see the business community not support the Arts and Culture District?
I don't know that it was. It came as a surprise to us. I think that, as Becca said, one of the things that it pointed out was the need for more information, the need for more community conversation around this. And the last week of March, I hope people will tune in, because on that Monday, March 29th, there's going to be a roundtable, and former Mayor Jack Thomas, who was, you know, right there at the front of things when this idea came up, will be on a panel with Mayor Bierman as well as with Max Doylny, talking about kind of the history of the district and where things are going now. And then on March 31st, we're having a special meeting, and that meeting we will be interviewing candidates for the new planning commission seat, and then there'll be about 2 hours allocated for public input on arts and culture. So I'm really hoping that people come out and, you know, share their opinions on where things are going with the new arts and culture district. So there's two opportunities there. But I agree. I don't think that people have all the facts, all the information that they need to be able to make informed decisions.
Now, based on your conversations with community members, I mean, what kind of feedback are you getting about the Arts and Culture District?
I think that there are real concerns about the cost. There are concerns about the timing. Why now? We're coming out of a pandemic, and we don't really know where things are going in the future. Those have been raised as concerns. I know that there are concerns about connectivity. How is this district going to connect with other parts of the community? How is this district going to connect with Main Street? How is it going to enhance what's going on Main Street? How is it going to connect with the library and the Santee Auditorium, as well as down with the Eccles Theater? So there's a variety of concerns about it, and those are why we have these public meetings. That's why we want to hear from the public. We want to hear what people's concerns are about it.
And is there, at this point, a majority in support of the project or opposed?
The public input that we received at the meeting so far has been positive. It's been from the arts community saying, this is very important to us. This is why we need an arts and culture district. We have not publicly heard the other side of those issues or those concerns. Those have been more on one-on-one private conversations that I have had with our residents, as well as I know other council members have as well. So that's why we're really hoping to hear different voices on the 31st.
Okay, finally, I wanted to ask you about just summer events. I mean, what's your stance on bringing back all of the summer events?
I'd like to know how we're going to mitigate things. You know, I mean, I am as eager, if not more so, than everybody else to get out there and, you know, have life back to normal and be at concerts and be outside and be at big, you know, festivals and all of that. But the devil is always in the details, and how can we do that safely? And at this point in time, I don't think we've had the in-depth conversations that we need to have about how to do that safely. I'm looking forward to our staff coming back to us. I understand that's going to be mid-April with a more in-depth conversation about summer events.
Yeah. And what specifically about the 4th of July? I mean, should we move forward with that?
I don't know how we can safely have 50,000 people shoulder to shoulder on Main Street watching a parade. And I don't know how you would limit those numbers of people, you know, as people like me that want to be out, want to just engage with folks, with people again. So how do you limit the numbers? You know, if we say, well, we can only have 10,000 people on Main Street, well, how are you going to do that? You know, how are you going to ticketed or try to cut off access to Main Street. So there's just so many details. You know, I'm really excited that we extended the contract with the Park City Market to coordinate 4th of July activities for the city, because talk about creative people. And if they can come up with a creative idea to spread the celebration out, I think that I'd be all for that. But as far as a parade, as we've known it in the past, I don't think this is the year for that.
All right. Anything else, Nan, you'd like to mention?
I don't think so. Just everybody, please. We are doing so well with our vaccine rates. So if you haven't gotten one yet, please look at how you might be able to make that happen. We want to get everybody vaccinated so we can get back to normal as soon as possible.
All right, Nan, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, data compiled by the Park City Chamber Bureau and the Historic Park City Alliance indicated a sharp decline in economic activity to start 2021, particularly for restaurants and lodging. KPCW's Sean Higgins reports.
Although official January sales tax numbers from the Utah State Tax Commission won't become public until later this month, 37 businesses participated in a sampling by the local business organizations and showed significant hits taken across all sectors in January and February. Restaurants and lodging bore the brunt of the damage, according to the data, with restaurants down an average of 31% in January and lodging down 54% over the same time period. After outperforming expectations in the fall, Park City Chamber Bureau CEO Jennifer Wesselhoff told KPCW the sluggish start to the ski season in November and December carried over into the new year, thanks in part to little snow to attract overnight visitors and increasing COVID-19 case counts. She said the big hit due to no in-person Sundance Film Festival was expected, but lodging did begin to bounce back some in February, with strong snowstorms causing an increased number of visitors and last-minute bookings.
You know, we expected that mostly because of the loss of Sundance. It was such a big hit for us, but also the impacts of the pandemic. And, you know, we did see some strong backfill in February, but still significantly down compared to, you know, what Sundance brings for our community in so many ways.
Wesselhoff added that February and March are looking to be in the ballpark of 35% occupancy, which is only 10% off the non-pandemic average of roughly 45% occupancy towards the end of the ski season. When it comes to restaurants and retail, the numbers are not always as straightforward, said HPCA Executive Director Allison Kulo. She said what complicates things is how not every business is the same. Some bars, restaurants, and shops did fine. Others struggled.
You know, different categories, different types of businesses have been impacted. So to say that all restaurants, you know, are doing well is not necessarily the case, or all galleries. It really is not necessarily across the entire board.
According to the data, bars saw the sharpest decline in January, down 75% month over month. Wesselhoff added that despite the rough start to 2021, there are indications the spring could bounce back and outperform expectations once again as COVID-19 vaccinations continue statewide and more people are willing to get out of the house and travel.
We're seeing the late season really performing much better than we had planned, much better than December and January.
Official state sales tax numbers are released on a two-month delay. January is expected later this month, and February sometime in April. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, Neural Performance Integration, or NPI, is a private medical practice in Park City, and it's recruiting 30 locals to participate in a study on chronic knee pain. On the phone with details, I have the lead on the study, NPI's research director, Beverly Albert. Good morning, Beverly.
Good morning. How are you, Leslie?
I'm well, thank you. So I think a lot of ears just perked up when I mentioned chronic knee pain. But why don't you first start by telling us a little bit about NPI, who you are, and what you do?
So Neural Performance Integration is a private medical clinic in Park City that's located right off of Kearns Boulevard. We specialize in the neurosomatic connection. That's also known as the brain-body connection. We assess, treat pain, dysfunction, and disease with non-invasive conservative methods like muscle manipulation, occupational therapy, balance and fall risk assessments, amongst many other things. I am the research director for Neural Performance Integration and the lead of this study. I studied kinesiology for University of Utah. And as you mentioned, we're seeking 30 locals to engage in this study on chronic knee pain.
So this study is apparently called an IRB-approved study. What does that mean?
So the IRB is the Institutional Review Board, and their purpose is to review and monitor research on human subjects. They ensure that studies are ethical and that the benefits outweigh the potential risks.
Okay. So as you mentioned, you need 30 people to do what?
So we need 30 people who will be randomly assigned into three different treatment groups. Those who meet our criteria will be randomly assigned to one of those three groups, like drawing numbers out of a hat. From there, based on where they're assigned, they will engage in a 12-week intervention. Those in group one will engage in manual therapy at Neuroperformance Integration for 20 minutes, one day a week, for 12 weeks. The second group will engage in at-home rehabilitation that'll last 20 to 30 minutes, and they will engage in that every day for 12 weeks, whereas the third group will engage in a combination of the two. We will be assessing physical functioning and pain before and after the intervention, and those who participate will engage in a questionnaire at the end.
Okay, number three is going to win, just saying.
We will see. Research does suggest that that will have the most positive outcomes, but right now there is a lot of gaps in the research, so that's why we're engaging in this study.
So what is the criteria for somebody to be considered for the study?
So those who would be eligible would need to be over the age of 18 and have been experiencing non-specific chronic knee pain for 3 or more months. Non-specific ultimately means that there's no specific problem or disease that can be pointed to the cause. So for example, if someone has been going to various doctors and has received diagnoses for their ailment, but they've been different, then that can be referred to as non-specific. It's clear that there's pain in the area, but it's unclear as to the cause. When we speak to chronic pain, we are looking for people who are experiencing pain that is ongoing, and that's typically due to a lot of little stress over time. The opposite of that would be acute pain, which comes from something suddenly and is caused by something specific.
Okay. So, I mean, are people who have had ACL, MCL surgery, I mean, are they eligible for this then?
So there is exclusion criteria or things that don't necessarily fit the population we're looking to work with. That would include knee pain due to surgery, knee pain due to trauma, or like I mentioned, that acute injury, knee pain due to a knee tumor, and so forth.
Okay. So there are orthopedic surgeons out there who apparently only operate on young people because their success rate is so much higher than if they had to average in old knees. So are you going to be including both young and old people?
Yes. Again, anyone over the age of 18 is welcomed to engage in the study on a first-come, first-served basis.
Okay. So what will it cost somebody to participate other than their time?
So it is completely free. We are providing this treatment to the community for no cost. We're covering all those costs. And there's even an incentive to join the study as Neuroperformance is Integration's way of saying thank you for dedicating your time to engage in this study.
All right. So how do people register or to be considered?
So if you are interested, we recommend that you go to our website to fill out an eligibility form. And to get to that form, please visit npipc.com/research.
And when would people find out if they're part of the study?
So between now and April 20th, I will be connecting with those who are interested in engaging. And then for those people who meet the criteria and who reached out near the beginning, I will connect with them directly and then give them the next steps between now and, again, April 20th.
All right. So is that when the study begins, April 20th?
Yes. That's when we will start collecting data prior to the participants engaging in their assigned intervention.
All right. And would they have to be in town then for the following 12 weeks if they're going to be part of this? Because it sounds like...
It really depends on the intervention group that they are assigned. If they are engaging in the rehabilitation, then they only need to come in for the first and second assessment day at the beginning and the end of their 12-week intervention. Whereas if they're in the group that will be doing the manual therapy, they can really live anywhere, but it might be more convenient for them to be in the area because they'll be engaging in the manual therapy one day per week in Park City. And that goes for the group who will be doing a combination of the two as well.
Okay. And what about those who suffer back pain? Any studies planned for them?
So we don't have any specific studies lined up, but right now we are in the works of expanding our research department. So we really hope to fill in those gaps as time moves forward.
Okay. Anything else people should know about this?
If you are interested in engaging in the study, we'd like you to know that we are planning on doing 3 staggered groups of interested individuals who meet our criteria. So this means if you're not able to commit right now, then come late summer or early winter, we'd love for you to reach out and hopefully have you jump in.
Okay. Beverly, appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Leslie.
Beverly Albert, again, with Neuroperformance Integration. She is their research director there. Well, the co-founder and current medical director of People's Health Clinic, Dr. John Hanrahan, has announced his retirement, this time for good. This is his third retirement from the clinic, but clinic executive director Beth Armstrong believes that he will be leaving for good as a staff member, but certainly won't be a stranger to the clinic.
I think third time's a charm. I really do believe that he's just come to a point where his career, where he's ready to just be a volunteer provider for us. So he's going to volunteer at the clinic once a week.
Dr. Hanrahan co-founded the clinic 22 years ago. He has served as both a volunteer provider and 11 years as medical director and as one of the longest tenured staff members. He's also one of the best known.
He has gotten a following among our patients, so he's very beloved and trusted among a large group of our patient population. So that'd be a big hole to fill.
She added that he has been a driving force in making substantive changes at the clinic and is always looking for ways to do it better. While he has big shoes to fill, Armstrong says they have found a great replacement. Dr. Mari Leining will be taking over as medical director next month.
Mari Leining, she's been a longstanding volunteer medical provider here at the clinic, and she's also a doctor who implemented this multidisciplinary diabetes program that we now have here at the clinic, and we brought in an RN to actually provide these services to our patients, and the Leining family actually funded this position here at the clinic. So she's already, even as a volunteer, was making huge differences in the care we provide here at the clinic.
That's Beth Armstrong. This transition taking place again April 15th. News time now, 8:55. Well, so far, the defendants at the state, county, and school district level have not filed any extensive replies to the federal lawsuit filed by 2 Park City parents. As we've reported, Holly and Mark McClure claim their families' rights were violated when their children were required to have COVID testing in order to attend in-person learning at schools. In the details of the lawsuit, they say that their 2 children are no longer being isolated under the Test to Stay program, but they fear that without court actions, the restrictions could return. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more on that.
The McClure's lawsuit was filed on March 10th against a string of authorities from the Utah Department of Health to Summit County to the Park City School District. Summit County Attorney Margaret Olson has told KPCW that they are currently reviewing the litigation. Tom Hudecko, a spokesman for the State Health Department, said they are unable to comment on pending litigation, but, quote, our goal has been to ensure Utah school children have access to safe, healthy, in-person learning opportunities. The McClure lawsuit says that a succession of state public health orders over the past year culminated in a directive in February that allowed education agencies consulting with local health authorities to install a test-to-stay program once an outbreak threshold, as they put it, had been met. The McClures have one daughter attending Treasure Mountain Junior High and another who is a student at Park City High School. In late January, both schools implemented Test to Stay, which required students to be tested at least once every 14 days. The suit says there was no option offered to parents to opt out of the continuing testing while allowing children not showing symptoms to attend in-person learning. The McClures told school officials that they did not consent to the program and their daughters did not report for scheduled tests. On February 3rd, they were notified by Treasure Mountain's principal that their younger daughter had been removed from her class, placed in a room with a teacher and a computer, and was told to stay there the entire day. The girl was told she was not allowed to visit the restroom between classes and could not eat lunch with other students. On February 8th, the older daughter, after missing two test appointments, was removed from her class at Park City High and placed at a desk in the hallway of the school's administrative wing. In late February, the girls were allowed to return to in-person learning, and in early March, high school students were notified that Test to Stay was on hold due to a significant drop in school cases and a reduced positivity rate in the county. But the lawsuit says the policy could be re-implemented at any moment if COVID rates begin to rise. The lawsuit alleges that COVID-19 testing offered at the schools is highly inaccurate, meaning that a large number of students could be falsely branded with the Scarlet C, as they put it. The McClures claimed the Test to Stay program from its inception has failed to comply with guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control. They allege under the state's health order of February, contrary to the CDC, the outbreak threshold is not based on community spread, but the supposed number of positive cases at a particular school. The state's COVID manual said the threshold for schools with less than 1,500 people would be 15 cases. Another flaw in the program, they say, is that adult teachers and staff can opt out of testing, but are still required to work in person. The suit says that rule is exactly backwards, given that adults are more likely to infect others. The lawsuit also asserts that COVID-19 poses a low risk to children and that transmission from child to adult or even child to child is rare. On the other hand, the suit says even the state admits that remote education puts students at a greater risk for poor psychological health and educational outcomes. The suit is making claims for violations of due process, equal protection, right to privacy, and violation of a parent's right to supervise, control, and direct the education of their children. For KPCW, I'm Rick Braff.
Well, you now have until May 17th with no penalty to file your taxes. The extension will apply automatically to all taxpayers. If individuals need more time, you will have to file for an extension and could be subject to interest. Despite the extension, people should still file as soon as possible. The extra month was to give taxpayers a chance to navigate the unusual circumstances related to the pandemic. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.